may already know some of the amazing story of 25-year-old James Blake's return to tennis. After a freak accident fractured his neck in the spring of 2004, Mr. Blake was hit by a rare virus called zoster that left half of his face paralyzed not long after his father died from stomach cancer. And yet, a little more than a year later, he was duking it out with Andre Agassi in one of the most memorable U.S. Open matches of the past 10 years. Mr. Blake tells his amazing story in a memoir that he's called Breaking Back. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased James Blake was able to join me today on my show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You mentioned that you'd never imagined playing tennis professionally until your freshman year in college at Harvard. Once all of these things started going wrong in your life, why did you then decide to continue to fight to play?
Well, that time of my life in 2004, when so many things were happening, it took away a large part of my life. It took away my ability to be as active as I wanted to be, and it made me realize how lucky I was and fortunate to be able to do what I had done for a living up until that point. And it really made me miss it a lot. And had it been taken away for good, I would have found a way to deal with that, and that way was with my friends and family and their help. But it gave me the new perspective to come back and never take any day out on the tennis court for granted anymore.
Were there times when you felt like giving in?
There were times when I felt like it might not be up to me. I felt like the virus that affected me could take a turn for the worse. It could just never get better, and then it really isn't up to me. It's just, I guess, a matter of fate. But luckily, once I got back, I didn't ever want to actively throw in the towel. It was a tough situation, but I always thought that I could do it if I was given the opportunity.
Is zoster one of those viruses that just runs its course?
Yeah, there's nothing much except for at the beginning when I had to be on a lot of antiviral drugs. Basically, it was just a matter of a ton of rest because it damages the nerve. And for me, it can attack any nerve. And for me, it attacked the facial nerve, which is the worst one because it affects your sight, your balance. It paralyzed half my face. And so for tennis, that made it nearly impossible to play at all. So
I don't see any lasting effects.
No, it's been okay now. So I'm very lucky. But as long as the nerve doesn't die, then it's just a matter of time until it's all going to come back. But the doctors really don't know when that will be. It could be as short as 6 months. It could be as long as 3 or 4 years. And for tennis players, 3 or 4 years would be just about a life sentence.
Well, you had a pretty terrific year in 2005, winning more tournament victories than you had before. What do you think was the biggest factor contributing to the success? Is it because you were able to come back?
I think being able to come back and having the perspective I gained. I think as a kid, or when I just started out on tour, I put so much pressure on myself. I wanted to win so badly that every point was kind of the end of the world type situation. And once I realized how important other things in my life were, my friends and my family, and how much those people cared about me, whether or not I won a tennis match, it gave me the ability to relax a little bit out on court and still work my hardest and do my best and want to do well and succeed for everyone else in my life. But it also gave me the ability to not put as much pressure on myself. And that's made, I think, the biggest difference in my game.
Because putting pressure on yourself just adds an extra burden.
Yeah, we already have so much pressure from the media, from our coaches, our agents, anyone around us that they don't put pressure on you on purpose, but just having them around, maybe there's the implied pressure that you want to do well and succeed for them. So to put more on yourself is just unnecessary, and to take a little off can make a big difference.
And we understand it in other sports. The foul shot with a split second to go that
yeah.
will win the game.
Yeah.
The guy comes up with the bases loaded, and he has 499 home runs, and this could be the 500th. You have to wonder what goes through somebody's mind at those moments. And and with you, we're not just talking about a moment. We're talking about a series of moments that goes on and on and on. You have to contend with exhaustion and all sorts of other things as well.
Yeah, and those are some of the moments that I really missed the most when I was sick is the moment when the crowd's going crazy and it's a break point, a match point, and you're just so excited about it. And what was going through my mind earlier was a lot of pressure, and now I want to enjoy it and I want to play my best tennis, and I think that's more possible now if I just enjoy those times and do my best and trust in the work that I've done on the practice court.
My guest is James Blake, who's written with the help of Andrew Friedman, Breaking Back, How I Lost Everything and Won Back My Life. It's published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Your story has been one that has inspired both tennis fans and people outside of the game. What was it like to discover how many people you had touched?
It's really amazing, and it's something that I've thought about since the book has come out, how many people I have the ability to reach, even with the breadth of the quotes on my book, from anywhere from President George H.W. Bush to Andre Agassi to John Mayer. To have people like that in your corner, to realize that the lives you touch is just so amazing, because I never thought playing tennis would open that many doors for me, and it has. And it's kind of making me take a step back, and that's something that I've gained in the perspective, is being able to take a step back, even in the middle of my career, in the middle of when I'm trying to do my best on the court, I can still take a step back and appreciate how exciting that is, and how hopefully helpful and positive my voice can be when I realize how many people I can reach. And doing the book signings and everything, I get a chance to personally affect people and have them tell me their stories, or tell me just a little bit about why my story can relate to them. And I really appreciate that, because most people can only see me on TV for a couple hours a day, and they see how I play tennis, but they don't get a chance to know the person inside. And I think this book can illustrate that much better.
But on the other hand, isn't it strange to know that people you've never met know an awful lot about you?
It is a bit strange, but I've sort of gotten used to that with the fact of living in the public spotlight a little bit.
Sports pages tell all sorts of stories, sometimes that you want told, sometimes you don't want.
Yeah, exactly. But I know that's the life I signed up for. And now the only difference is I've put my friends and family into it as well. And I never would have done that without them knowing, or without them supporting me and letting me do that. And I'm so proud that my mom appreciated the way this book turned out, because I wanted it to be an accurate depiction of my father and of our family. And as long as she gave it her blessing, then I was really proud of it.
You talk about how you felt like a pretender on the court during your comeback. And Torre wrote in his review in the New York Times that this could still be influencing your tennis. Do you think that he was being fair?
Well, I think the incidents in 2004 definitely still influenced my tennis, and I think they'll influence my life throughout the rest of my life, because to lose a parent too young is something that I don't think anyone will forget, or it will not affect their life, whether it be in their job, in their personal lives, in their relationships. It's something that has an effect when you lose a parent too young. So I think it definitely affects me. I try to find silver lining in everything, and I try to find a positive way to have it affect me. Like I said, in my perspective on the court and being a little more relaxed, I definitely don't ever feel like a pretender out on the court anymore, being the fact that I've been in the top 10 now for over a year, and something I was never able to do before 2004. I was never able to crack the top 10. So now, being a top 10 player, being a Davis Cup stalwart, someone who's helped get the team to the semifinals and hopefully even further, I feel like I can compete with anyone on my best days.
You talk about losing a parent too young. That's just one of a number of things that have happened to you. Mm-hmm. But is that the one that that cuts deepest? After all, you fractured your neck. Mm-hmm. You had zoster. Mm-hmm. When you were a kid, you had scoliosis, which is almost almost guarantee that you're not going to become an athlete.
Yeah, but all of that stuff definitely pales in comparison to losing a parent. All that stuff was physical pain or anything like that, and I think it's apparent just in the emotional strain. I never realized how much emotional stress can do to you physically, because the zoster really came about from the emotional stress of losing my father, and it's definitely something I would never wish on my worst enemy, to have to see their parent go too young. He'd been so healthy his whole life, and to be stricken by cancer the way he was, it was difficult. But I definitely think that one affects me the most, because I really do think about him every day. I don't think about my neck every day. I try to think about my illness, because I'm so lucky to be able to use my face again and to have all the abilities I have. But I definitely think about my father every day. So that's the one that definitely hurt the most.
You only barely touch on it in your book, but you're also one of very few African-American players of the sport today. Is it something you think about when you're on the court?
I really don't think about it too much. The times I do think about it are when people talk about the whole role model idea of the fact that you're in the public spotlight, so kids are looking up to you. And I realize that there might be some kids looking up to me because I am one of the few African Americans on tour, and that makes me feel even more responsible about being a role model, because I know that I want to portray an image of someone that that did it the right way, through hard work, through dedication, through a love of the sport. And I want to show kids that it's possible from just about any situation to get there. But I also want to promote the fact that I didn't take this as my only road. I also want to make sure they have education as the plan, because I know, like you said, with scoliosis, there's the greater chance is that I was not going to make it as a pro athlete. I talked to my coach about it, and if I at 12 had said I think I'm going to make it as a pro athlete, I figure I might as well have gone out and bought a lottery ticket and had the same odds.
Well, the whole business of role model probably weighed a lot heavier on Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing is that, considering their success and how much they inspired kids, that there aren't more African American tennis players, and that we're even having this discussion.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful for Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe and what they've done, and people like my father, what they had to live through in the 70s and 60s, and in times when racial tensions were much higher, and it has made it so this entire interview or all the interviews that I do aren't totally about race. It's made it so much easier for me to be accepted in this sport. And I think the Williams sisters have done a great job in today's game in inspiring young African-American girls to play. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And I appreciate when I get the chance to work with them on any sort of campaign to promote it to any sort of inner city kids or anyone that really wants a chance to play the sport. But it's really tough in America to compete with the major sports, the baseball, basketball, and football. And we're doing our best, but there's still a little bit of a stigma out there that it's a country club sport, and we're doing our best to break down that barrier.
And you have had to deal with some incidents of racism, including one with former number one player Leighton Hewitt.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested that you were getting good calls because a lineman was an African American and he was going to favor you.
Yeah, and that was an incident that happened in 2001, kind of my first my first foray into the public spotlight, because that was my first win at the U.S. Open and my first time on a big court. I was playing him on Louis Armstrong, and to have that kind of an outburst in the middle of a match, it was on TV, was something I don't know if I was ready for, but I really didn't think about it at the time because I was mainly just focused on winning the match. And we made up that next day. We talked about it in the locker room, and he explained that it was just the heat of the moment and it had nothing to do with that. And I let it go and just gave him the benefit of the doubt. And that's something that my parents taught me was tolerance and not just jumping on someone right away and thinking the worst right away. So I do try to have that kind of patience when it comes to that. And since then, Leighton and I have been fine.
But in tennis, there often are screaming fits.
Yeah.
At least some players do it. You have resisted, but over the years we've seen players really act out in mm-hmm. very embarrassing ways.
Yeah,
is it because there's just so much emotion invested in it?
Yeah, I think there's so much emotion, there's so much hard work that's gone into guys getting out to where they are, and then being out there alone, you feel isolated sometimes, and the only person I guess you can maybe act out upon is the umpire or yourself, and guys have done that, and it is embarrassing at times. There are times when I know even the people that do it are embarrassed later, and we as fans or spectators can be embarrassed for them, but it is just true emotion out there on the court, and it's just I can't say I'm immune to it. Every player at some point has probably done something that they didn't think was appropriate, and they feel bad for it later, but I've gotten to a point where I understand that there are kids watching, and I'd much rather set a better example and be a good sport on the court, because when I was a kid, I had the role model or example to look up to of John McEnroe, who was not setting the ideal example. He was tossing his racket and throwing tirades against umpires as well.
And saying things that you didn't want to hear on our television.
Exactly. And so that's probably maybe part of the reason I was such a brat when I was a kid. But as you get older and you try to enjoy the sport more, you realize that's not the way to go about it.
My guest is James Blake, who, with the help of Andrew Friedman, has written Breaking Back, How I Lost Everything and Won Back My Life. It's published by HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with James Blake, the tennis star, who's written a book called Breaking Back, How I Lost Everything and Won Back My Life. It's published by HarperCollins. Can we go back a bit? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut. I was born in Yonkers, but I moved to Connecticut when I was about 6 years old.
And your father was involved with the Harlem Academy?
The Harlem Junior Tennis Program was where I first learned how to play tennis. It was a program that's all volunteer-based. The kids can play there for free as long as they bring in their report cards and have a solid grade point average. And if you don't, they have what's called the Homework Club, and it just has a group of tutors that'll help you out and get you on the right track education-wise. And so I learned how to play there, and my dad was one of the teachers, and he would help the kids learn how to play tennis, and he helped me learn how to play tennis. And
is this before you had scoliosis?
Yeah, I played at the Harlem program until I was about 11 or 12 years old, and then I started. We would come back, even when we went to Connecticut, we'd come back every weekend to play in it, and then it was tougher for me to get competition at it because the players weren't as strong as some of the ones in Connecticut, and I started coming back more as a volunteer. I would come back and just be a part of the homework club and help the other kids out, but I wasn't diagnosed with scoliosis until I was 13 years old.
And then you had to play with a brace.
I wore a brace. I didn't play in the brace. I wore the brace for 18 hours a day. And what I was able to do is I would take it off as soon as I was done with school, and I'd play some tennis for the afternoon usually, and then I'd have to put it right back on.
Do you think that was one of the things that spurred you on?
I think that helped give me a little bit of the perspective I had even before all this stuff happened in 2004, in the fact that I went to the Shriners Hospital for Crippled Children, and going there, I was one of the very few people, patients at least, that was able to walk in and out comfortably. Without the help of prosthetics or anything like that. And so it made me realize how lucky I was to have my health at all. And all I had to do was wear this plastic brace throughout high school, which to most kids would seem like an absolute nightmare because that's when everyone's so self-conscious and you're worried about getting a date, having a cool car, anything like that, and you don't want to have to worry about your back and wearing a big, bulky plastic brace. But it gave me a chance to find out who my real friends were, who the people were that didn't care about that kind of stuff. And I like to think it made me grow up a little quicker, and I really appreciate that.
I've heard that you have slept on the floor to ease the pain. Do you still do that?
When you're traveling,
hotel floors?
As recently as about a month ago, I slept on a floor in a hotel in Europe because if the beds are too soft, I just feel like it's going to hurt my back and I'll wake up in the morning with some pain. So I'd rather sleep on the floor. It's harder and that's better for my back. And the bed I slept on when I was a kid, once I was diagnosed with scoliosis and my dad heard that a harder bed is better for you, he basically got a piece of plywood and put it on top of cinder blocks and got the thinnest mattress he could possibly find, and that was my bed. And so I got very used to a hard bed throughout high school.
So now when you book a hotel room, you just try to make sure that you find a place where the carpets are really clean.
Exactly. As long as they're clean, I'm happy.
You talked about the Williams sisters. Well, your brother, Tennis, also attended Harvard, also plays tennis professionally. Mm. Do you practice against each other the same way the Williams sisters have?
Yeah, we've practiced together a whole bunch of times, and we've been competitive at just about everything our whole lives. Tennis was the one thing that we really never competed against each other seriously in, because we knew how important it was to both of our lives, so it wasn't something we could joke about. We could joke about who won in Nintendo or who won in cards or anything like that, but when it came to tennis, we both just took it seriously, and we had trained together and work as hard as we could, and it was really a treat to play on the same team as him in high school for 1 year and in college for 1 year. And I learned so much from him. To have a big brother like that, I couldn't ask for anything more. He taught me through example. He taught me through leading me, through actually teaching me lessons. And he was he's someone that's always there in my corner. And he's a constant presence in my box at the U.S. Open and everywhere. And throughout a crowd of 20,000 people at the U.S. Open, he's the voice I hear first. And it's something that's really a joy to have.
You talked about being on the same team. And in the book, you talk about how much you love to play Davis Cup tennis, which is team tennis. Mm-hmm. Now, you seem to be a rarity in the United States. The younger players are not as excited about playing in the Davis Cup as they were in the past.
Yeah.
It's become more of a me sport, do you think, than a...
Well, I think tennis is a very individual sport to begin with. So I think what works for one may not work for others. So it's tough to say there's always one specific generation that does one thing or another, but... we have definitely rallied around of late our captain, Patrick McEnroe, and to have guys like Andy Roddick and the Bryan twins, myself, Marty Fish. We really enjoy the team aspect. We have so much fun, and I think a large part of it is just the fact that we all want to see each other succeed. We've gotten along so well. We all came up together through the challengers. We've seen Andy bear the burden mainly on his shoulders of dealing with all the pressure of who's the next great American hope and who's going to win the next slam and all that kind of stuff. So we all feel like we've been helping him for many years in dealing with that. Now I feel like me and him have been dealing with that pressure for the last few years together. And it's something that we enjoy doing together, and we enjoy playing on the team and being a part of hopefully something special where we can win the Davis Cup. But it really is something that we want to succeed.
But it hasn't happened recently.
It hasn't happened recently, but this year we're already in the semifinals, and I think this is going to be our best chance. We've got we have to play Sweden away in September, and I really like our chances this year. And I think with the camaraderie we have and the amount of effort we've put into this team, I think one of these years we're going to bring home the cup.
But, you know, you mentioned Andy Roddick. You and Andy Roddick are probably the leading American players right now. Mm-hmm. Many have wondered if the dominance of American men in tennis is over, especially with the retirement of Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi. And I wonder about playing in an environment where Roger Federer, many people think, is the greatest tennis player that ever lived. Mm-hmm. The only person who doesn't seem to think that is Rafael Nadal.
Right.
Where such dominating players are out there, and no matter how good you are, you have to wonder whether you stand a chance.
Yeah, it's tough to say whether the dominance of American tennis is over. It's really tough to say if any one country can dominate the sport ever again the way America did in the 70s and 80s with possibly the best generation of players ever with Sampras, Agassi, Courier, Chang. And it's going to be tough because the sport has become so much more globalized with having more and more players and more opportunities in so many other countries. It makes it so it is very difficult for any one country. And we were the only two countries with two players in the top 10 last year, us and Spain. And it just is very difficult to have one country dominate the way it did in the past. And I don't know if it'll ever happen again. We've got two players that are dominating right now in terms of Federer and Nadal. But that's, like you said, possibly the greatest player of all time and also possibly the greatest clay courter of all time. So it's a tough generation to rack up a lot of slams if you're not Federer and Nadal.
Well, how do you psych yourself up? I mean, I always wondered what it was like to go in the ring with Rocky Marciano, who never lost a fight, mm-hmm. or with Muhammad Ali, who you were pretty sure was going to do great. Mm-hmm. You have to tell yourself that you're going to win.
Yeah.
But how do you do that when you're going up against Roger Federer?
Well, against Federer, I haven't had as much success, but I've had some very close matches with him. And every single match I've gone into it with him, I've thought I could win. And I just have to play my game and concentrate on that. And he is human, so there's going to be errors he makes. And if I play my game, I can hopefully make him defensive and make him react to me. Every time he's gotten the better of me so far, but... And after the match, I've come off thinking, you know what, there wasn't much I could have done today the way he was playing. But that just takes me back to the drawing board, back to the practice court to work on getting better. And every time I've stepped on the court against him, I feel like I've gotten better. So I think it's just hopefully a matter of time until I can continue improving and get whether it's one win or two wins or however many chances I get against him. I'd like to keep challenging myself that way.
Well, I'm not sure from what you just said whether winning is because your opponent is having a bad day or because you are having the best day you could possibly have.
Well, I think for me, winning is continuing to get better. And I felt like I've gotten better in many of the matches I've played him, whether it be before I played him or during the match. I feel like in seeing how well he plays, he is, in my opinion, the greatest of all time. So to play against someone that talented, you're going to find out where your weaknesses are and what he's picking on and what he's doing to beat you.
Because he'll spot them right away?
Well, because he can attack them. Other people might be able to spot them, but they can't execute the way he can. So for me, it's a matter of playing that match is going to make me a better player. And that's something that I can hopefully work on and be better the next time I play him. It may not be even necessary against a lot of other players in the world, but against him, you know you need to improve that. So it's a constant reminder of the work that needs to be done.
My guest is James Blake. He's written a memoir called Breaking Back, How I Lost Everything and Won Back My Life, written with the help of Andrew Friedman. Now, what do you mean by breaking back? Because you fractured your neck, but you didn't break. The only thing you don't seem to have broken is your back.
Yeah, well, for one, it was kind of funny because when I did fracture my vertebrae in my neck, they couldn't read the MRI or the X-ray in Rome because of my scoliosis, because my back was so curved, they weren't sure what the problem was, and I was having a lot of pain in my back, what they called referred pain, from my neck down the nerves into my back. So they really didn't know if I had broken my back as well. So I was over there still with the diagnosis of, we definitely see a fracture in your neck, and we're not sure if you broke your back as well. So to call home and tell people that you broke your neck and you might have broken your back too is not a fun call to make. But also, it's a little bit of a play on words on the breaking back on the tennis court, where when you break someone's serve, you win the other guy's serve, it's called a break. So if you get down a break, a lot of people think the set might be over. You're down already. But that's when a lot of the great players are able to break back. And that's what I felt like I did. I was down at a certain point, and I didn't feel like it was over, and broke back.
Well, you strike me as having the straightest posture of anyone I've ever seen. So has all of this really improved your posture?
Well, I think that's actually from wearing a brace for 4 years. When you wear, I never really notice it, but when people mention it, they tell me that they think my posture is very straight, and it's something that was forced for 4 years. You can't have enough teachers or parents tell you sit up straight, and it might not have an effect. But if you wear a brace for 4 years straight, 18 hours a day, your posture's going to improve. So it definitely made a difference, and I don't even notice it anymore. It's just, I guess, the way I sit or the way I stand is very upright.
You've been less successful this year with some early exits in the slams. Why do you think you've had those troubles?
Well, it's been something where at the French Open, I played a guy named Ivo Karlovic, who's 6'10" and has the ability to really take you out of the game. Because he can just serve so well at times that it makes you kind of ineffective. And
a complaint many people have about the men's game, mm-hmm. that all too often it's just a guy who hits a lot of aces on the serves, and that's the end of that. And a lot of people like the women's game better because there's a lot of volleying.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you like it better too.
No, I definitely like the men's game a little better. I just, it's what I know, it's what I'm used to. And I think it's a matter of dealing with the greater power that's come into the game with technology and with guys' training methods. And in baseball, you see more home runs, and that's exciting. In baseball and tennis, I can understand how some fans might not think it's as interesting, because anytime there's a break point, you think there might be there's just going to be an ace, a big serve, and the point's over. But it adds to the tension sometimes, and it's to see who can come up bigger in those few moments that might be you might only get one break opportunity in a set, and who can take advantage of those opportunities. And there are also still, especially on clay, there are still those guys that can play long rallies. You see Rafael Nadal is number two in the world, and he does not have a very big serve at all. He's able to do it with his ground strokes and being able to grind and stay out there longer than anyone else.
Well, that's because clay really is a whole different game from
grass.
Yeah,
you're able. It slows down the ball a little bit more. You have more time to react. And for the guys who are natural movers on it, it gives them the ability to defend and play much deeper in the court.
You play tennis full-time. You also found some time to write this book. You appear in numerous magazines and on television. How do you balance it all?
Well, that's something I learned when I got to school, was I ended up doing much better in school during the tennis season, when you're able to manage your time, when you know you need to be at practice at a certain time, you know you need to be doing your schoolwork for a certain amount of time, and you know you need to be in class for a certain amount of time. And so when I was working on this book, I felt like I was very effective, because I knew there were certain times when I had to do these things, and it made me manage my time a whole lot better. And I haven't had a whole lot of free time for most of my life. The only time I really had a lot of free time was when I was sick, and I was at home, and had a lot of time to just think and be with my friends. But other than that, I feel like most of my life I try to keep pretty busy, and this is a way to keep busy.
Well, a number of people have felt that all the distractions have had an effect on Anna Kournikova's game. there have been some recent developments in tennis, including allowing some coaching at some tournaments and allowing players to challenge line calls. Mm-hmm. Do you think these are positive developments?
I think making changes is positive because we should see what works with the fans. And so I'm always a fan of the experimentation because that's what's going to lead to a bigger breakthrough and hopefully helping the fans. The Hawkeye development with the challenging calls has so far been great for the fans. The fans have enjoyed it. It's taken a little bit of the human error out of the sport, and I think it's been great for the game. Coaching has only been tried on the women's tour in the last couple of years, but I wouldn't be opposed to seeing it tried on the men's tour. The traditionalists are saying that it would take out the mental battle of one player against one player and not being out there all on your own. But if the fans like it and if it adds another personality to the court, then I'm all for it. And I think it's still a battle between one-on-one.
You also talk about playing a lot of poker in the book. Yeah. Do you see poker as related to a tense tennis match?
I feel like I've learned a little bit from poker. I can't say I can relate them directly, but in poker there are times when you get just bad luck and you need to bounce back. You still have an amount of money or an amount of chips or whatever on the table, and you still have to make the right decisions and play the same way and not get down on yourself. And one of the biggest things that some of the poker players I've been privileged to meet have told me is patience is one of the most important things. And in tennis, I feel like that's also important. You can be down a break, you can be down a set, you can be down whatever, but if you're patient and you still just play your game, that's still your best chance to win no matter what the score. And so I think that's something that has related a little bit, but it is still very different when you're doing it with just a couple of cards in front of you as opposed to running and moving very physically around the court.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but in a month you'll be back at the U.S. Open, the slam you generally perform the best in. Mm-hmm. Do you like playing in New York?
I love it. It's a dream come true. That's where I was a fan. I grew up watching that tournament, and I still will always be a fan of that tournament. So to play on Arthur Ashe Stadium is just an honor for me, and I still get goosebumps there.
Because the fans are also knowledgeable?
The fans,
or is it just that it's home?
It's home, and the fans are so supportive. It seems like it's tough to get New Yorkers excited about any one thing, but to get them for 2 weeks, they get so excited about the U.S. Open, and that means a lot to me.
Well, James, I'll be rooting for you.
Thank you very much.
James Blake, his memoir, Breaking Back, How I Lost Everything and Won Back My Life. It's published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, the American prison population has increased dramatically since the late 70s, and we will look at a new study about how incarceration affects the employment prospects of ex-cons. Then actor Jim Dale describes becoming all the characters on the Harry Potter audiobooks, plus a new novel from Carol Muskie Dukes about a woman who teaches poetry workshops to female inmates. And then Ed Schoenfeld, the Chinese food expert, explains how to order a meal in a Chinese restaurant and why the people at the next table always seem to be eating something you didn't see on the menu. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Brad Ludlow, Kim Gittleson, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.